right, let's let it rip. Listen up. We are back for another episode of the Construction Mentor Podcast. My name is Ike. I am your host. You can follow me on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, at The Construction Mentor. What are we here to do? We're here to promote the industry, the construction industry. We're here to make sure that people are aware of the opportunities that are out there, the lifestyle that they can live, and how to tackle them. And if you're already in the industry, we want to make sure that we're giving you a helping hand to take your career as high as you want to take it. So today, I'm excited because I have somebody on the podcast that I think has the best construction memes out there. That's how I found him. His name is Matt. And he has a career that I don't think most people are aware exists in the construction world. So definitely before you get into the rest of this episode, make sure you go on Instagram. You go to, although he goes by Matt in his day-to-day life, he is the construction Yeti. His tag is literally like a red Yeti walking across the screen. So Matt, how are you doing today?
Good, man. I gotta start by saying I'm a little disappointed. I thought you would be on your exercise bike when we did this, but I see you always, but I guess we have to record at like 3 a.m. to do that though. I always see all your stories.
We would have to do that at 3 a.m., but the exercise bike is easily one of the best investments that I've made in a long time, purely because I can, like, obviously, like, I'm big on, you know, personal development and working out and stuff like that. But like getting that 45 minutes of cardio in while I'm also able to like crush work as a, as a dad with another one on the way, is a total game changer for me.
You can't see it, but I'm in my home office right now, and over my corner there's a Peloton bike in the corner, and it's collecting dust at the moment. I really need to get back on it. And
so that's what I really want. That's what I really want is a Peloton. This thing was $500. Pelotons are a little more expensive than that. So where are you in the country, and what is your job description? Because again, I don't think a lot of people are aware of where you are in the industry, because I was in the industry for 10 years before I understood what your job title was and that it actually existed.
Yeah. So I'm based out of the Houston, Texas market here in Texas. I work as an owner's rep, and kind of like you, I was on the subcontractor side before I came over here. And I knew that there was this guy or whatever on whatever project that was sort of the owner's rep, but I had no clue what he did. When you're a subcontractor, like you know, you're working for the contractor and you don't really realize what's above and beyond that. Right. And kind of in the contractual thing. But what an owner's rep is, you know, they may work for a school district or a college or a municipality or even like a private developer. And so there's kind of two ways that one, like a school district, they're not in the business of building schools, right? They're in the building of like teaching kids. So they may get a school bond and they need to go build a new high school. And they may not even know where to start, right? I mean, their level of construction is maybe, you know, painting the walls, fixing, you know, maybe more maintenance type of things, right? Changing out air handlers, that sort of stuff. So we come in and we're a neutral third party with like really no interest other than basically their self-interest, right? You know, contractors, they're going to have some sort of self-interest, right? Because they have to make a profit. They'll say we're looking after the owner, but at the end of the day, they have other motives. Architects always like to say, well, no, we look after the owner's best interest. Well, they still have some sort of motive at the end of the day. And they're not going to go do something which is going to impact them negatively, right?
Right.
And so we can be a watchdog for the owner. We can help the owner make good decisions through the design process. Then through construction, you know, we make sure they're getting what they paid for. You know, they paid for plans, they paid for specs, and make sure they're getting what the plans and specs call for, right? So real high level, yeah, that's what.
So it's almost like if I were to oversimplify it for somebody who's not in the construction industry, it's almost like when you go to buy a house, you hire a real estate agent because you don't buy houses every day. Or it's like a lawyer, like you don't spend every day in a courtroom, right? Like you need somebody that knows the boundaries and the rules of the road to make sure that you're getting what you need. Now, you mentioned a few clients out there, client types. Are you able to share like what some of your actual clients are, like who you actually represent? If not, it's okay. I'll throw some out there just as an example.
Without saying any specific names, we do a lot of public type projects. So like school districts, municipalities, counties, working on the county courthouse expansion rebuild program right now. We don't do a lot of private developer work. Just that's a kind of, when you're in the public world, we're trying to get in the private developer world, but it's just, you know, there's more relation. They don't publish. You can't go find the RFP posted on the website for a private project. You know what I mean? They don't publish it. Mm-hmm. So it's a little hard to break into that.
So for people that are just to follow along, because I like just connecting with the dots, I think one of the things that we do poorly as an industry is we use jargon that is everyday language to us that other people don't know, right? So when Matt says RFP, that's a request for price, or that's an invite to bid a project. Right. So if you were interested in doing public work for any of the stuff that Matt has as a contractor, you'd be able to go on a website and it's public. So you're able to bid that. Whereas for a private contractor, you need to either know the architect, the client, you know, the end user or an owner's rep like Matt to get on that bid list to say, hey, you know, you can be one of the four or five people that bid this job.
Yeah, because public work, when I say public work, I'm talking about, you know, I think everybody knows what that is, right? It's the government type of stuff. And they have rules and regulations and laws that tell them they have to, you know, basically bid stuff out fairly. So, you know, you'll hear every now and then that the city manager, you know, was handing his brother-in-law a project under the table, you know, all those sort of stuff. So there's laws that can keep that sort of stuff from happening, right? So they have to publish it. They have to advertise it. They have to announce that we're going out to bid for this sort of stuff to keep it fair, right? If you're building a building with your own money, you can hire your brother-in-law all you want to, right? Because it's your own money. It's not the public's money.
Right. And what I would say as a person who has done both public and private, and I'm not going to put words in your mouth. You don't have to acknowledge what I'm saying, but the public sector needs help, right? It's no different a lot of the times than if you were to walk into the DMV or something. Sometimes if you see road work or something like that going on, there's a reason that it goes on for a long time. So having an educated person or a consultant in there to help move that along is a benefit to everybody, even the taxpayers. Like you want somebody in there that knows how to move these things along and navigate and be that intermediate.
Yeah. And I'll say too, I mean, when I started off as a subcontractor that did primarily federal work, and I don't do any federal work right now. So I'm not throwing any clients under the bus or anything, but like, it made me like, I was like 23 years old, fresh out of school, whatever that was. Right? And I was like, man, just the amount of wasted effort we go through and all this sort of stuff made me like sad and depressed as a taxpayer, right? I'm like, I barely became a taxpayer, like my first job and all that sort of stuff. But like,
well, in my experience, and again, so I'm in the opposite world now and I'm totally private. Everything that I do as a GC is private and I'm working nationally. But when I first moved to Florida, I was working for a couple companies that were doing public work. And I'm not saying that all public work, you know, happens like this because I don't need anybody coming after me. But on the projects that I saw, knowing the amount of paperwork that goes into it, like if there were some smaller contractors, mom and pop people that were just going after projects because they saw the dollar signs. And I talk about cash flow all the time. Getting involved in public work, if you don't know what you're getting into, can hurt you pretty bad. Big because time. There's so much red tape, the cash flow just might not be there. So like if you can't float a couple 10, 100 grand for your payroll, then you got to be careful. And now on the flip side, what a lot of people end up doing, and the reason that a lot of contractors do like public work, is because they'll incorporate the financing in their bid, right? They'll either make it worth their while, or, you know, if they're operating on a loan, they'll make sure again that it's covered for on the cost, right? They're prepared to wait, which means that, you know, you're paying more for public work sometimes. Again, you don't have to acknowledge that if you don't want to, but
I'll see contractors that come from private world, maybe in like, you know, a small, like they build, I mean, not dishing these guys, but building like storage buildings or, you know, 7-Elevens and, you know, kind of just talk about commercial, right? There's varying degrees of commercial construction from the guy that's building like the 7-Eleven down the street to the guy that's building the whatever massive billion-dollar stadium they're building right now, right? It's all commercial work. But when you go to the public side, you get some of those guys that are trying to make the transition from private to public. And they're like, did you read the specs? You got to do this test or whatever this is, right? And they're like, no, the specs, that's just a suggestion. You know, you don't have to do that.
Yeah, it's boilerplate. It's boilerplate. Yeah. That's on every drawing. They didn't actually intentionally put that there.
Yeah, right? I don't have to do that test. I've been doing this for 10 years. I've never done that test. Yeah. I'm like, now I'm here to make sure you do that test, right?
There's a huge benefit to knowing the rules of the road. So with your career, talk to me about the beginning. Like, have you always been an owner's rep or did you get in on the subcontractor side? Any experience with being a GC? What's your road to being an owner's rep been like?
No, I've been owner's rep now for 5.5 years, roughly. The first 10-ish years, I was in the subcontractor side. The first company, I graduated college in 2010. You know, we're still coming out of the recession. Like, you couldn't find, you know, it was so hard to find a job. And I got, you know, the federal government was still spending some money. So I got in with that subcontractor who was doing a lot of federal work. I didn't understand anything about federal contracting. I graduated with a civil engineering degree and I didn't understand project management. I didn't know what an RFI was. I didn't know what an RFP was. I had to submit it. Like, all these words were foreign to me. So I kind of had to self-teach myself of how to be an actual construction project manager. So when I first got out of school, you know, I didn't really understand project management at all, right? I had a civil engineering degree with a specialization in project management, but I didn't understand RFIs or submittals or really any of the project management, construction management basics, right? So I kind of self-teach myself. And then I went over to another subcontractor. I was a mechanical and plumbing subcontractor, and I had to learn that trade, you know, that discipline. And again, it was a little bit more developed. They were a little bit bigger company, so they had better processes. So I was able to learn that. And then about 5 years ago, I was kind of looking just to do something different within the industry. And that's when I came over to the owner's rep side. So I've never been at a general contractor, but I've seen, I guess I've seen it contractually. I've seen the general contractor from two angles, right? I've seen from like the subcontractor looking up and the kind of the owner side looking down. And I kind of thought, man, if I were like, if I ever ended back up on the subcontractor side though, like, or even general contractor side, I would like, I think I'd be way more effective. Now being on this side and being able to see the full process, the big picture of kind of how the whole thing plays out. Because when you're a subcontractor, you kind of got your blinders on and you're kind of, you're only worried about kind of your trade, your scope, your budget, your everything. And you kind of like, again, like I didn't really understand what an owner's rep was. I didn't really understand like that if I'm writing a change order proposal, I'm not trying to sell it to the general contractor. I'm ultimately trying to sell it to the owner, the owner's rep, right? Because they're the ones that are ultimately going to pay the bill, because the GC is going to end up having to go and, you know, pass it on upwards. So,
you just highlighted two points right there that I think are really interesting. Number one, did you actually ever use your civil engineering degree?
No, I was never, I got halfway through engineering school and I was like, screw this. I don't want to do this.
It's funny because I know so many people that are even in interiors, like construction, right? Like they don't do core and shell at all. Like they've never developed a site in their life and they have a civil engineering degree, which I think is funny. Because, you know, we say like, if people should go to college, they should go to college for, you know, engineering, mathematics, construction management. But I do think that there's like a conversation to be had about, okay, well, how necessary is it really? Because like, if you have a civil engineering degree, that's great that it got your foot in the door in the construction industry. But then, you know, most people I know that have civil engineering degrees, like don't actually use them. I mean, I got a mechanical engineering degree and I even was working as a mechanical engineer when I got out of school. And I would say out of my entire mechanical engineering degree, only two courses were relevant to HVAC. Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, did civil engineering, got halfway through it. And I was like, I don't want to be a proper civil engineer, like sitting there doing these drawings, and all this sort of stuff. Right. Kind of saw it. And I looked at transferring to like a construction management. We had at Texas A&M, they have construction science. And I kind of looked at that, but it was going to set me back like a year and, you know, cause you gotta take some different classes and that sort of stuff. And then I realized that civil engineering, you could specialize in construction project management. I was like, okay, perfect. That's where I'm going to go. But it was just real high level. I still had to take one structures class, one transportation class, one of all these classes, which I'm glad I did, because that kind of, it did give me a, like, I understand how traffic and stuff flows better, right? Which I probably wouldn't have got. So it kind of gave me a more well-rounded thing. It also put me into the business school by doing that, because I had to take like a finance class and a business management class and some of those other things, which I ended up doing a business minor. I took one or two more classes to get the business minor, which again, like I cannot be an accountant by any means, but then I take an accounting class, so at least it exposed me to a lot of different things. Right. And so I think that was good. As a project manager,
you know, the other thing that I would say is, and you've experienced this, but just entering into the industry, there's so many avenues open to you. Like you got an engineering degree and that, or you went to school for engineering, that exposed you to the industry, you got in the door. And you were in the subcontractor world and you bounce around and now you're on the owner's side. And an owner's side isn't even something that most people are even aware of. And you've already alluded to the fact that in the future you could go to any side given the experience that you have now. So as somebody who has, you know, lived on site, you know, with the subcontractors and been through the pressures of that area or of that perspective, and you probably understand very well what the pressures of the GC are like from seeing it from both sides. What do you prefer? Do you prefer being on the owner side? Do you prefer being on the sub side? Is it a little bit of both, and why?
It depends on the day, probably. Like I like being on the owner side when I'm not getting those phone calls at 7 o'clock at night that we have a plumbing leak and we're flooding out the new hotel. Like I don't miss those phone calls. But at the same time, being on the owner side, you're kind of a little bit more removed. Like I still live on the construction site. We have a trailer on the construction job, right? So I'm still out there, you know, basically all day, every day for the most part. And so I'm still involved, but you're kind of the outlier, the outsider. You're kind of still not in process, right? You're like, and it's, you're kind of more of a traffic cop during construction, right? You're kind of just making sure everyone's like doing what they're supposed to do. And you're like, hey, you're behind schedule. Hey, like you installed that wrong. And you're a little bit less, you still get involved, but a little bit less of the problem solving. It's less, you know, when you're, you know, on the subcontractor side, and probably the GC side too, right? There's some sort of game to it, right? You're trying to beat the budget. You're trying to beat the schedule. You're trying to motivate your team, right? There's, you know, it's a little team, but there's still a bigger project team being on the owner side, but it's just a different flavor, if that makes sense, right?
Yeah. So I think, you know, from my perspective, and I spent a little bit of time on the owner's side, I would say you hit the nail on the head. It's like your job, especially when it's, you know, after you're in contract negotiation and getting the project going and set up and everything like that, your major lift or responsibility after that is holding everybody accountable, right? Like holding the architect accountable to answer, you know, RFIs and keep the job going for any questions that happen or anything like that, making sure they're invoicing properly. Same thing for the GC in the field, making sure that they're holding up their end of the bargain for quality control, adherence to the schedule, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. You're less problem solving. Like if, you know, the proverbial shit hits the fan or there is a problem on site, you're not the person figuring it out. You're just making sure that everyone's figuring it out and holding them accountable for it.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we can give our two cents, but, you know, say, hey, I think this is my opinion, but, you know, there's still a contractor still has means and methods, and I'm not going to get into necessarily how the architect answers the RFI or something, because that starts opening me up for liability.
Well, you just went where I was just going to try to interrupt you to go. It's like, and you see this in municipalities too, with inspectors, right? Like people expect the inspectors to tell them what to do. Like, tell me the answer to the test so I can do it. Well, they're not going to do that. And the owner's rep isn't going to do that, because then they gave you direction and then they're liable. And that's not what the purpose of their job is supposed to be.
I can, So I can say, hey, this is kind of my thoughts. You do whatever you want to do, but this is kind of what I'm thinking, if this helps you, you know what I mean? So you can help problem solve in that way, but you can kind of just see them on a death march and you're just like, hey, you got a problem. But you know, it's kind of,
so I think it's a unique opportunity, right? It's something that a lot of people don't understand is there. So again, if we were to consolidate what an owner's rep does, it's, they represent the end user, the client. So whether it's the public sector or the private sector, where I'm at with it, you know, Facebook, Google, Apple, you know, all these clients, these major companies that you hear about, most of them, 90% of them have owner's reps in between the build team, the design team, and them. Some companies, like I've done work for Liberty Mutual, they have their own internal owner's representation team, right? Which, same thing. It's just that they own those people. Now, where was I going with that? Oh, so, and they're setting up the job, negotiating the contracts. And then once the job goes out there, they're, you know, holding everybody accountable for quality control, schedule adherence, proper billing, things like that. Now, what does somebody get paid for that job? I mean, is there an entry level position? What would that look like for somebody coming out of school to get into versus, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20 years down the road? Because everyone wants to know what the money is about, right? So what does an owner's rep get paid?
I don't know across the entire industry of owner's reps, because it can be regional and it's all that sort of stuff. But yeah, there's a lot of times owner's reps, you know, a client hired you because you have experience. And so they want somebody, they don't want a full team of college grads, because like, hey, I'm hiring your experience, right? At the end of the day, you're still sort of a consultant. And so if you just got a team of people that have been out of college for 3 to 5 years, you're like, where's the experience in this, right? But there is a fair amount of, we call it like administrative work, you know, I guess too, that, you know, kind of those lower, more entry level positions can be filled. So they can kind of learn and get the experience as they coming up. Yeah, it's probably similar pay to, you know, say, project management staff on kind of a subcontractor, you know, kind of depending on experiences and everything else, from 60 to 70 up to, you know, mid 150s, kind of in that range.
Yeah. So that's what I would have expected. I think, you know, for people that come out, everyone that I've spoken to, or that everyone that I've worked with on the owner's side, that is really good and worth the time. It's very obvious how much time they spent on the builder side, whether it's a subcontractor or a GC, or even the design side, right? Like a lot come from the architecture world too. So it's, you can come from any angle of the industry. A lot of people basically over the course of their career, they end up going towards the money and wherever the money came from, if they don't elevate, you know, on the builder side. So 60 to 70 to start wouldn't surprise me. And I guess, you know, up to 150 as somebody with some experience, maybe 10, 15 years experience would make sense to me. But I think you bring up a good point. If you're trying to maximize your value in going into that seat, I don't think I would recommend somebody go into being an owner's rep or try to be an owner's rep right out of school. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's funny. I actually, a kid, I call him a kid because he's still a college student. He's about to go into his senior year of college. And he reached out to me on LinkedIn. It's somebody I've kind of messaged back and forth with over the last couple of years, because I put out a lot of kind of, I'm always trying to help the next generation kind of coming up. So I put a lot of that content out, especially on LinkedIn. And this guy reached out to me and he was like, hey, I'm going in my last year of college and I'm kind of just interested in what else is out there, because everybody is in a construction management program. And he was like, everybody just goes work for the general contractor, right? And he was like, there's more out there, but I just want to understand what that is. And I actually had a phone call with him a few days ago where I kind of walked him through it. Like, well, I'm an owner's rep. This is almost the exact same conversation. Explain what it is, explain what it does. And that was kind of some of the advice I gave him, was like, you're going to be way more valuable, I think, if you were to make that shift later, when you understand the building science, understanding kind of what a labor budget really looks like, because I've been very granular on the subcontractor side, right? Cause like I put together like daily plans, weekly plans, project budgets, project schedules on a very granular level for like, you know, putting together a 5-man crew. Oh, hey, you're literally hanging this one thing of pipe today, like that low. And we need 5 hangers, you know, and that small, all the way up to where I'm at now, where I'm seeing, you know, the 35,000 foot view, and I'm seeing kind of all of the big pieces start floating together. But I do think, kind of to answer your question a little bit more directly, like I worked for a plumbing subcontractor before I came over here, plumbing and mechanical, HVAC. And we've got a very pretty diverse team. Like one guy's a master electrician on our team. Like I'm sort of became like the mechanical expert. And so it's given me more value in that, because like, you know, a lot of general contractors don't really understand the MEP trades to really in depth. Right. And so to provide that value, like, oh no, I understand the mechanical side of stuff. I understand, you know, plumbing's a little easier, I think, but to be able to, I think it's given me more value than just being well-rounded. At least I kind of specialize in a trade, which has kind of helped me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, you know, when you think about it, just take a step outside the industry, young people, and think. If you wanted somebody to represent you, you're trying to hire them as an expert so that you're being protected. Do you want somebody that's been driving on the road for a couple of years or just got out of school? Or do you want somebody that's actually been in the shoes of the people they're managing? Mm-hmm. Right. So Matt has been on the subcontractor side. He knows what it's like to coordinate as a subcontractor and be with the GC and, you know, push the project from that side. So when he's going to a client, you know, they know that he has the expertise to keep everybody accountable, because he knows what it's like to operate as they do. Right. So,
and even then I'll say, you know, if we're doing a constructability review on a project, which means for people who don't know what a constructability review is, so early on in the design process, one of the earlier stages before you get the full construction drawings, you may sit down with the plans and the specs and kind of go through it, make sure it all works. One, to make sure it's meeting the client's expectations, what they want out of the program. But then two, you know, just making sure all the pieces are there, they're not missing something obvious and all that. And so you really want a well-diverse team doing that. And so I've been brought in to be like, do the mechanical review on different projects because of that experience, because I can look at them and understand those drawings better than somebody who's more, you know, well-rounded, or maybe they came from the civil side, or maybe they're an architect where they understand, but they don't really understand it down to like the granular level. That makes sense.
Sure. Yeah. And like I said, I mean, as a builder, you can tell who's been around the block and has you know, valuable experience and feedback. Mm-hmm. Right. And those for us, those are the best people to work with, right? Like those are the best clients and client reps to have, are educated people that we can have a productive conversation, and you're not always teaching, right? It allows us to concentrate on the meat and potatoes of a project and actually have meaningful conversations and not just be kind of like meandering around and then arguing for the sake of arguing. Mm-hmm. Because of those people too, there's such people that like to argue and they're really good at arguing, but they don't know what the hell they're talking about when it comes to building. So, you know, we always talk about entrepreneurship opportunities, and it's very obvious in the sub world, like, you become an electrician, you can start off as your own person, you know, a one-man crew, and then you can grow to 3, 4, 5, 10 people, and then you go from there. And you can do the same thing as a GC. Do you have any perspective on starting as your own owner's rep? Because I know a lot of people, and even architects, right, that have gone into their own, where they're their own one-man kind of consultant. And I have some examples of what they can make, but I just want to get your take. Is that something that you're interested in doing? Do you know a lot of people that have done that? Do you have any perspective on that?
I don't know anybody who's made that kind of win. Let me take it back. I've known people who have been kind of one-man consultants and have kind of done stuff like that. I don't probably have enough insight to really kind of know what the rates are and all that sort of stuff. I imagine, you know, anytime you're a successful entrepreneur, right, you're going to make more than you make as a W-2 employee, just kind of by the nature of things. It depends on what you take on too, right? You know, I have all the, you are the overhead, right? So all that overhead, even if you're building across the board, all that overhead technically, it comes back to yourself. Yeah, I probably don't have enough insights, but I do know that it's
just, well, and you have no cost, right? Like you're just yourself.
It's just you.
You have your insurance and maybe some software or a computer.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're a small business right there, you can write off a lot more of your expenses, you know, that you wouldn't be able to do, you know, as an employee. So probably helps in that way as well.
That's so I toyed with that idea because I think a lot of people, when they hit like that 10-year mark, they think about going to the owner's side because they see less stress in the solving problems in the field and being held to a schedule and then being reliant on 15 subcontractors to like get it done. And they're just, they get fatigued with a lot of the building stuff. And they feel like going to the owner's side and holding people accountable is a better, more juice for the squeeze, right? In Florida, I have seen people go on their own and they represent country clubs or, you know, local private developments like shopping malls, strip malls, not shopping mm-hmm. malls, like, you know, the strip malls that yeah. have like 5 to 8 businesses in them. And I actually had somebody represent a charter school that I was building, about a $20 million job. And they were on it for 4 hours a week for a year. And they made $200,000. Insane, yeah. right? Another one, I did a high-end country club. And I think the guy was billing 10 hours a week for a year. And he made $250,000. He used to be he was an owner's rep, this guy that I was working with. And he used to be an executive at, I don't want to get too specific because then people will know, put it this way, he was an executive and regional vice president for several top 10, ENR top 10 builders in America. Mm-hmm. And he basically took that resume and now he's down in Florida. And he has all these HOA boards and all these big developers that want representation. And because he has this resume with this awesome experience mm-hmm. on it, he's able to charge. What I heard is that he was making $2 million in 2023 as his own consultant with 5 or 6 clients.
I totally believe it. I mean, when you get the experience, like, if you don't know what you're doing, you go hire the attorney, right? To write your contracts, to represent you, make sure you're not getting yourself in legal trouble. If you're going to go start building something, if you're stepping off into something you don't know, like you need to have experience, you know, on your side. And so somebody with a ton of experience that can really look after you, he could probably name his price, right? For the right clients. So.
Yeah. And I think the moral of the story is, because we keep going back to that same point, it's experience, experience, experience. The more experience, the best education you can get is experience. And the more experience you have, the more people can trust mm-hmm. you, the more value you have for yourself, the closer you can step up to the money. The closer you step up to the money, the more you're taking people accountable. It's a different kind of stress. It's still stress, but it's a different kind of stress. But it seems to be what everybody's after, right?
And that's, you were talking about earlier about college. And like I do think an undergrad is probably good for, you know, engineering, anything technical like construction, all that sort of stuff. But I've had people too, like, hey, I'm graduating my undergrad. I'm going to go do construction, like get my master's in construction management. What do you think? I'm like, you need to go get a job. You need to get boots on the ground experience. You need to actually learn. You're going to learn more theory, but you're not going to understand what happens on the job site. Like, go get your boots dirty. Like, go out there and actually learn what they're doing. You're going to get way more experience out of doing that than you're going to get out of another 2 years in college.
What do you think? I think we've all seen this. People come out of Texas A&M maybe, or University UT or something like that. I see it out of UF down in Florida. I've seen it in New York. You get college kids that come out of college. Not only do they think they should be in the C-suite right away, but they step on site and they seem to be dead set on conveying to everybody that they're the boss. What do you say to the kids that come out looking to be somebody's boss on site?
You know, maybe I've been lucky. I haven't really dealt with that much. Most of the kids I've seen come out are, maybe they've been humbled before I ran into them. But no, I honestly can't even say I've really seen that too much. But I mean, to your point though, I mean, you're coming out trying to be someone's boss. Like, just for your first few years, you just need to absorb as much as you can. You just ask as many questions as you can. Like, go talk to the, you know, that cranky superintendent that's got 40 years of experience, right? Go pick his brain before he retires. You know, we're about to have this mass exodus of the baby. I guess we're in the middle of it, right? This mass exodus of the baby, mm-hmm. baby boomers retiring. We're going to be losing so much knowledge. Just go pick their brain, learn from them. If you show you give a damn, a lot of those old cranky superintendents will kind of take you under their wing and, you know, they'll give you shit. They'll pick on you. They'll call you. Yeah. You know,
it's a good thing.
Yeah, no. If they don't pick on you, they don't like you. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And I think the crankier the better. I think it's proportionate, right? I think the crankier they are, the more they know, and the more they have to offer. You just have to pull it out.
Yeah, but if you show you give a damn, you show you're trying. Like, you don't have to pull it out as much. They'll start mentoring you and kind of helping you out and kind of teaching thing here and there. So
you've been around, right? Talk to me about. And we're going to wrap this up probably after this, but talk to me about what you see talent from the owner side across the board I mean, do you look at GCs? Are you noticing a difference in subs? And as some of these older people leave, the talent level, do we have an issue? Is that something that people talk about on the owner's end?
I haven't really had those conversations. I mean, I've had those conversations online, I guess, because I kind of do, I don't call myself a thought leader, but I put out a lot of content on LinkedIn and have a lot of conversations with people. And then, you know, I end up having conversations with people on like through my memes and stuff on Instagram and that sort of stuff. But yeah, you know, I probably like during my day job, I probably haven't had those direct conversations, but you will see projects though, where, and I mean, I've been on a couple of really good projects since I've been over here, but I'm just kind of what I've heard through the grapevines on stuff on other projects and people kind of moaning and complaining about projects though. You just kind of being underqualified maybe, because maybe they don't have that 30-year experience superintendent, right? That's kind of, you kind of got the next wave coming in because those older guys have moved out of the industry or whatever. But I haven't seen it, at least where I'm at, I haven't seen it too terribly bad.
Okay. Interesting. I can tell you, I see it. You know, I have quite a few project teams and I've seen it. And it seems to be getting exponentially worse since about like 2019.
And
maybe I'm also just rising in my career, so I'm more aware. Maybe it's been there for much longer than that. I don't know. But
you know, I mean, and I guess I've been blessed too, because I've been on a really good project for the last couple of years. So it's like, you know, whenever you're in a happy spot, like all you see is like the happy stuff, right? And you're in kind of bad spot, all you see is bad stuff.
So we talk about that. You know, I've talked about that. There's a benefit and there's a good and a bad with large projects. If you're on a large project and you love the team and you're going to be on it for a couple of years, that's great. You know, you got it good. When you have smaller projects and you get a bunch of them, you know, you're going to have a lot more turnover. So you're going to get mixed in good and bad. Mm-hmm. On the flip side, if you're on a large project and it sucks and you hate the architect and you hate the GC and you hate the owner's rep and your life sucks for 2-3 years. Yeah, it could be painful. For you're in hell for a long time, or purgatory, or whatever you want to call it. So, hey, before we wrap up, talk to me about Construction Yeti. Why? Where does Yeti come from and why did you start it? Like, what's your goal here?
Yeah. So Yeti actually came from me when I was in college. I played rugby for A&M and it was our summer break and winter season of New Zealand. And me and my buddy went down to New Zealand and played a season of rugby down there. And I thought it'd be cool in like 2009. It was in that range between where mullets were cool in the 90s and before they're cool again in the 2020s. And I had a mullet. Thought it'd just be funny. And so anyway, I went down there playing with a mullet and our team trainer called me the Yeti because I had a mullet, but whatever, that makes sense. And so when we came back to Texas, my buddy's like, that name's Brink coming back. So like everybody, like all my friends in the rugby world know me by Yeti. And so when I just started this whole thing, I just called it Construction Yeti.
I mean, I'll tell you, it's catchy. Like, I don't know what it meant. I just looked at it and I was like, Construction Yeti, I have to follow this guy because it was just interesting. and then I got lost in your memes one day. Your memes are hilarious, by the way. I truly think that you have the best memes. I've tried to replicate, not copy, right? I've been very conscious. I always try to check, but I can't do it. I just can't do it like you. Not my talent, which is, it's fine. We all have our thing, right?
It's like, you know, it's something I've kind of fallen into because I've tried to do different kind of content and like I've done pretty good stuff on like LinkedIn and that sort of stuff. And, you know, I kind of really got started in the social media stuff because I do a weekly newsletter on Substack. And then I started this thing a couple of years ago and I was like, well, I got to go. It's free, but I got to go sell it to get people to subscribe for it and grow mm-hmm. the subscriber base. So I turned to LinkedIn and started posting more on LinkedIn and kind of built up traction there and, you know, almost like 10,000 followers on LinkedIn. And then I went to Instagram. I was trying to think what I was doing on LinkedIn, put on Instagram, and like that wasn't working at all. And just a completely different vibe. Definitely started making a couple of these meme videos and it kind of popped off. And so I was like, okay, I kind of like this, where you can take a painful topic of the construction industry, kind of poke fun at it with the meme. And then you kind of like in the caption, you know, write, you know, and I have a conversation about the topic. You know, I've done things about, you know, superintendents, you know,
being
judged, yeah, being miserable or being judged when they take time off, right? Like,
that was one of my favorites actually, because I've had that conversation.
Everybody has, and it's like, you know, so let's, you know, kind of poke fun of it, and everyone's like, oh yeah, no, I get that, I feel that pain, I've been there, I've seen that, and then we can actually have a legitimate conversation about it. So it's just kind of been fun, and so it's the Instagram thing's been, it's kind of popped off, but yeah. I've seen a lot of people try to do it and it's kind of,
it doesn't work for everybody. It doesn't work for me. I've had one that's gone off very well. It was about back charges. Other than that, like it's pretty flat. So I don't think I'm going to do it unless I really think that I got a good one. But it was funny because when you posted the meme about the superintendent going on vacation, which was hilarious, it made me think of a super that I had on my job site when I was in Boston. And this was a guy that client reps that we'd have, regardless of the end user, we'd have the same, you know, client reps over and over and over again. And they would demand that he was on the job. His name would be written in the contract. This guy's the super, right? Been around 40 years, knows his shit. Mm-hmm. They know that they're going to get the truth out of him, which that's another problem, right? Sometimes supers just say too much and it's like, you got to put a muzzle on him. It's like, dude, shut up. Like, don't tell the client that you think they're an idiot or, you know, whatever. Sometimes it can go that far. But he would, at 2:30, we could be in a client meeting. He would stand up, put his jacket on in the middle of a conversation. The client could be mid-sentence and put a cigar in his mouth and walk out the door because it was his time. His day was over and it was his time to go home.
It was quitting time and he was out.
It was quitting time and he was out. But because of his experience and the amount of respect that the clients had for him, although they would probably never allow anybody else to treat them like that, you know, he would be able to do that. Right. And I'm not saying that that's something that you should strive for, but it just speaks to the level of respect that experience gets you and the value that you bring to a project that you can kind of call your own shots and put your foot down and say, no, I work from 6 to 2:30 and then I'm home and you got my all. And I'm going to do everything that I can to put us in a good situation to win. But when it's 2:30, I'm putting my cigar in my mouth and I'm hitting the train. I'm going home.
And you could probably say, if you want to continue this conversation, show up at 6 tomorrow. And the client's like, well, I'll be there. I'll talk to you at 9.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So what have you noticed? Have you noticed any trend between memes? Like, is it inflammatory stuff? Is it making fun of the supers, the trades? I have noticed a little, when I make fun of myself as a GC, the trades love it. I've noticed that. Do you see any other types of trends?
You know, as an owner's rep and stuff, I like to make some of myself as an owner's rep too, right? And like, I make a couple videos like making fun of the GC or making fun of the subcontractors, right? And then I'm like, well, no, I gotta make fun of the GC too. So like, I'm an equal opportunity make funner memer, I guess you want to call it.
You don't discriminate. You make fun of everybody end to end on the job site.
I mean, I'll make fun of myself, the architect, the art, you know, but it's because those are all conversations that need to be had though, right? And that's the memes just became the kind of the platform to get people's attention. It's just the medium to get your attention to stop. And then like, oh, this is the topic we're talking about, right? Because everyone laughs at the meme because it resonates, because it's real. And like my wife will like see it and she's like, I don't know how this thing got like 2 million views. This is the stupidest thing. It makes no sense. I'm like, well, you got to be there. Like, you just got to understand nuances, right? Like,
right. So. Yeah, there's a reason that they go off. And I actually, the Backcharge one went off like 4 weeks after I posted it. So I don't know. I don't know how they got that snowball got rolling, but yeah. And I think that was it. Like everyone had felt the pain in that situation. Everyone's been through it. And I think the more people that are incorporated in a meme that can feel the pain, obviously the better it will share.
Yeah.
So what is your intent? Like, where do you want to take it? Do you just want to grow a platform like as a community? Do you plan on monetizing this in some way? Where do you take Construction Yeti?
Yeah. So right now other than the social stuff and the memes, it's a weekly newsletter. We did a podcast last year. We're kind of looking at relaunching the podcast this year, kind of similar to what you're doing. I call it the CM Mentors podcast. And we bring on guests and talk about, really trying to help the next generation of construction managers kind of coming in. So we've done that. I'd like to build it out into a full media type brand, almost kind of following like, you know, almost like what Morning Brew's done with kind of what they've built their platforms. That's kind of my vision. I've also learned a ton about marketing. I'm a construction guy. Like I took one marketing class in college that was part of my business minor, but like, you know, you don't learn anything doing that. So like, I'm not formally trained in marketing, but I've just learned a lot about like how to build community, how to talk to people, kind of the psychology behind that sort of stuff, how to get attention online just by doing, right? And so I've actually partnered with a guy we've launched a fractional CMO business to help contractors that need help with their marketing. And so that's kind of where this thing's kind of monetized itself. You know, eventually I'd like to build up the Construction Yeti brand into being a monetized asset with ads or however that looks. But we're currently using that to build up this fractional CMO, Chief Marketing Officer service.
Interesting. So are you talking about like small subs or GCs, like whether it's residential or commercial? Like where do you see the pain points are for them? They just don't know because they're cavemen and they don't understand how to market their business.
A little bit of that, you know, yeah. Kind of small to medium sized contractors, you know, or architects. We say the whole AEC world. Primarily, if we could like handpick a perfect client, it'd be like a smallish, medium sized contractor, general contractor, where they realize they need a market. They kind of maybe hit plateaued in their growth. Because when you start off, it's really easy, say, to get to $5 million, right? Because you just get going, you can get some clients, and then you just kind of hit a plateau. And so we can provide, you know, all the social media, all the web design, you know, the proper SEO things. We got a team that does, like, they're ninjas at doing like paid ads on all the Googles, the Metas, the LinkedIns, all those sort of things. Actually being a strategy person to help you grow, but also as you grow your company and revenue, your staff has to grow kind of equally, right? And so partner Ryan, he's got, I mean, he's a ninja all this stuff. He's always been in the VC world. He's got a ton of experience on like the staffing and recruitment and that sort of stuff too. So he's really good at the talent acquisition marketing. And so those got to go hand in hand, right? If you go from $5 million to $10 million, well, you need to bring in a whole bunch of A player project managers to your team. And if you're not branding yourself properly, like an A player is not going to go work for, you know, Joe working out his pickup truck, right? They want to go work for the A teams. And so if you look like Joe working out his pickup truck, or, you know, these guys, they don't have it together, you're going to attract the D players, and then it's just going to be this messy cycle, and you're not going to get to where you're going to be.
Let's plug that. Where do people find you? If you're a contractor, if you're a small architect, engineer, contractor, whether it's GC or sub, where do they find you for their chief marketing service?
I mean, you can reach out to me directly. You can send me an email at matt@altcmo.net, or you can go to altcmo.net, and that's our website. Our website also talks about too, because we have a team, or say through partnerships, of helping completely on the fractional C-suite thing. So, you know, if you're a growing contractor and you realize you need, you know, fractional marketing support, we're not a digital marketing company. We're not going to, you know, charge you per keyword, per social post, all that sort of stuff. Yeah, like, right. No, we're an executive on your team, but, you know, we'll talk about a little bit on their website too, about, you know, full C-suite stuff. Cause we got people on our partnership that are fractional CFOs, fractional COOs, because a contractor, once they get to a certain level, like, they need to upskill their team. Right. And a lot of times, you know, you'll pay.
You got to go from college to pros, or from AAA to major league. Like, if you don't have the infrastructure, you're going to crumble. You're going to lose.
100%. Again, talk about experience. If you don't have the experience on your team, you're not going to be able to make that step up. And so, and to get an experienced C-suite executive, you're going to be paying $300,000, $350,000 after benefits, right? To get somebody with that experience on your team, right? You're talking about the guy that's, you know, working for the country clubs, making $2 million a year, right?
Yeah.
He's doing all sort of a fractional level, right? He's a fractional construction manager for all these guys.
Right.
But he's selling his experience. So that's kind of what we're trying to do, is really come in and help these people. And we've looked at a couple different SEO audits and paid ad stuff. And it's becoming more and more obvious every time we look at something that, you know, if you're a general contractor, you know how to vet a subcontractor, right? Because you understand the industry, you understand the scope. You may not really understand all the nuances of being a mechanical contractor, but you understand it enough where you can vet two different contractors against each other and know what you're getting a better value of. But if you're a contractor, you know everything about construction. You don't know a thing about SEO. I've seen people, like, honestly, we've been doing a few different audits of different clients and that sort of stuff. When we look at we do an SEO audit, and like, you've been paying an SEO company for a year, for instance, you've been paying a monthly retainer for a year, and they don't even have the low hanging fruit checked off on the technical stuff on your website. And it's like, man, like, it's just, but they don't know what they don't know. And it's,
damn, you got to go check out mine. Listen, SEO is great. I mean, I don't even know, search engine optimization, I think, is what it stands for. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is how everybody finds you. I mean, even for me, you know, like, whether it's Google or my YouTube videos, I've realized that if I put certain words in certain places, I get significant differences in traffic, like, not tenfold, like 100 or 1,000-fold. So it's something important to understand. And we, just as builders, we don't think that way. You know what I mean? And if you're trying to grow your business, or you're trying to, you know, gain awareness, or trying to build a brand, which we should all be trying to do, I mean, it's key. You have to be able to do it. So the other easy way to connect with you too would obviously be Construction Yeti. Just DM you, right? And then
DM me on Instagram, Construction Yeti. I mean, if you're on LinkedIn, Matt Graves. I think it's Matt Graves PMP CCM, because I got a couple, because there's a bunch of Matt Graves, so I had to do something to, I guess, sort of to stand out.
A few abbreviations after there, or acronyms. Well, listen, Matt, I appreciate you coming on. I know you got a lot to get to today. So make sure you go follow Matt on Instagram @ Construction Yeti. Do you have any other platforms or is it just Instagram?
Instagram, LinkedIn. I've played around with TikTok and Facebook and that sort of stuff. But I mean, most of my efforts on Instagram and LinkedIn.
Okay. So mainly Instagram. Go follow him at Construction Yeti. Again, in my opinion, he is by far the best construction memes out there. I tried to replicate it, couldn't do it. So I'll just defer to him and just share his when I really, really like him. And of course, you can follow me at The Construction Mentor on YouTube, Instagram, TikTok. And you can catch this podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or YouTube. Again, feel free to reach out to either of us anytime. We're here to help people. That's at the root of everything that we're both doing. So, Matt, I appreciate you coming on, and I'm positive that this is going to reach the right people. So, thank you.
Yeah, cool. Thanks, Ike. Appreciate you having me, man.